And last week's workshop have really shown me just how hard kinetic theory can be. So I'll try to keep this talk very simple. What confuses me particularly about kinetic theory are these scaling limits. It's hard to understand what the limit means if the rules are changing along the way, as they do when you rescale space, time, momentum, and so on. So I'll try to tell a few stories, paying particular attention to the scaling and what it means. So I'll start with the classical derivation of the Vlasov equation, a la Braun and Hepp and others. And I'll start by considering particles whose positions and momenta I'll call Q and J. The superscript isn't a power, it's just an index to show that I'm considering an n-particle system. So there are n positions and n momenta, and the equations of motion are just Newton's equations, where the interaction is the electrostatic force. So each particle feels the electrostatic force due to all the other particles. So here I'll put a QNJ minus QNK over the third power. And this is what I want to study in the limit n tends to infinity. So I'd like to consider a scaling in which as the number of particles goes to infinity, the density of particles in space doesn't increase. It remains constant. So I'll consider you might say, n particles in a box of volume n, but I'd rather talk about the dynamics on the whole space, three-dimensional Euclidean space. So instead, I'll rescale and oh, yeah, I'll just consider one species, namely electrons. You could introduce another species of ions, several species of ions, and so on. But to keep things simple, I'll just have electrons.
There's no background neutralizing force, or to keep them in place, it's just going to
expand. You could also add a force here if you like to confine them. That's not essential, and I'm leaving it out not because you can't do the work otherwise, just because it's that way I don't have to write as much. So when I rescale, I'll define the rescaled position as I want to take this, since the number of particles is going to infinity, the region of space I have to consider gets larger and larger in proportion to the number of particles so that there's a constant density. So I want to rescale down so that everything stays in the same place. And so I'll define the rescaled variables to be n to the minus one-third of the unscaled variables. That keeps the density constant. I mean, three dimensions, definitely. That's going to prove very important in a second. Okay. So now let me rewrite these equations for the rescaled variables, and you'll have Qn, the rescaled velocity is the rescaled momentum divided by mass, and the rescaled momentum is changed by the force, So if you do the substitutions and the rescaling, you'll find that the force is rescaled by 1 over n. And it's at this point that a derivation like the one of Braun and Hess makes sense, because the 1 over n scaling, which is sometimes called the mean field scaling, it comes very naturally out of this picture, this scaling limit, if you will. So the general theorem is, well, the situation, let me call, since I have to think about both position and momentum, let me give a name to the pair, this phase point, I'll call it gamma. So gamma nj stands for what you think it does. And this kind of equation of motion looks like the time derivative of gamma nj has the form 1 over n times the sum over all other particles of some interaction. And when you have a situation like this, if the interaction is nice enough, then there are rigorous theorems that tell you in the limit n tends to infinity, you get an effective equation for the density of particles. And I'll write down a statement of that in a moment. But the first thing I'd like to do is to make everything true. So I've used the real electrostatic interaction with its Coulomb singularity to get this scaling. But now that I've done that, I'm going to cheat, make my life easier, and really consider a mollified potential. So I'm going to consider a potential without this singularity in the rescaled space. And one point of concern is that even if you truncate the Coulomb singularity in rescaled space and then scale back out by a factor of the cube root of n, the truncated region becomes huge, but ignoring that, I'm going to rewrite the dynamics. What I'd like to do, please, is to replace this force term here by some force which is not as singular, and to get things to work, it's all right. You just need it to be Lipschitz and bounded, the force. So S is now an abbreviation for a non-singular model of the electrostatic force. Okay, so the theorem is that if you look at, suppose that initially you consider the empirical measure in phase space of the initial positions and momenta of the particles. So I'll call that you look at this measure. At each phase point, you put a point mass, and then you divide by the total number of point masses. That gives you actually a probability measure on phase space. Suppose that this converges to some measure mu naught on phase space. If F is bounded in Lipschitz, then at later times, if you look at the same kind of empirical measure, but of the locations of the particles at time t, this converges weakly to a probability measure mu t, another measure on phase space. And this these measures, or this family of measures, satisfies the Vlasov equation. It satisfies a Vlasov equation. So mu t is a weak solution of the Vlasov equation, which I'll write in terms of a density. There it is. So that, this is a theorem. Right here. So when you think about the n-particle system, each particle has a position and a location, which I conflate to a point in phase space. Each of these points in phase space put a point mass there. Right. It's I suppose. In any case, it's a measure, a very singular measure that just tells you where the particles are. Whereas this measure could be very smooth. It could have a density. The important thing conceptually about this theorem is something that Eve pointed out last week, that you don't need any ensembles to make sense of this theorem. You just need a lot of particles which you can approximate by some continuous possibly continuous distribution on phase space. So Klementowicz theory, which I don't know, but from what I've heard, it involves ensemble averaging, but that's just not necessarily part of the story. So this theorem is often credited to Braun and Hess, 1977, but in fact, the probabilist Henry McKean proved something much more general back in 1966. He considered these kinds of processes like this, where there's also possibly some diffusion added in momentum or in position and momentum.
What do you mean by your mu?
This is some probability measure on phase space. It might be a continuous one, which would be, say, represented by a function of position and momentum, and you think of it as a function against which you integrate to get probabilities. So if you'd like a quick picture, here's phase space, and n is a large number of particles. And those particles might concentrate in some positions of phase space more than others. So when you have enough of them, you can imagine, you can approximate this very pointillistic distribution by a function f of q and p, or more generally by a measure, probability measure. That's right. So this is weak convergence. Absolutely.
While some people use phase space only for the n-dimensional one.
Right.
Which is across many.
Okay. Thank you for pointing that out. Right. This is a single particle phase space. And you take. So the initial condition is actually one phase point in many particle phase space, but you can map that to a kind of empirical probability measure on the single particle phase space. So that's the story. Now I'm going to obtain the same Vlasov equation, show how it's obtained, beginning in the same scaling. that is constant density and same rescaling of space, but starting from, instead of starting from classical Newtonian dynamics of particles, I'll start from the quantum dynamics of particles. So that is, suppose I've got a wave function. Okay, quantum dynamics. So the many electron Schrödinger equation, I'll write this way. Again, there can be background potentials and so on, but I'll leave those out. I'll have, you've got kinetic energy, and you've got electrostatic repulsion. Again, there are only electrons. You can maybe add a background charge and so on. But I'll ignore all of that. So here what we have is 1 over... So those are the dynamics. Okay, again, I'd like to rescale. Do the same rescaling of space and momentum, well, just of space, so that, say, I'll have xj, I'll replace rj with xj, which is rj over the cube root of n. And now, thinking of the wave function as a wave function of these rescaled spatial variables, the Schrödinger equation becomes, well, the same thing it was, but with an effective Planck's constant. Now the spatial derivatives are with respect to the rescaled variables. And here, I have the same business, except now I'm dealing with X's instead of R's. And making this change, I'll need to put a... oh, dear. Right. I'll need a 1 over n cubed, 1 over the cube root of n. And here, wait, let me do this a little bit more carefully. So I do a straightforward substitution. Here I get a 1 over cube root of n because I replaced r with x, which are related by a cube root of n. And here I'll get 1 over n to the 2/3 because of this second order derivative in space. This is just a straightforward rescaling. Now, what I'll do is multiply both sides of this equation by n to the minus 2/3 so that you'll get IH bar n to the minus 2/3 here, d by dt on this side, and on this side you'll get H bar over n to the minus 2 over n to the 2/3 squared over 2m in front of kinetic energy, and here you'll get a 1 over n. So this rescaling gives me, after multiplication by n to the minus 2/3, gives me a 1 over n in front of the interaction, and it gives me an effective Planck's constant of h over n to the 2/3. Giovanni.
Thinner, for example. You also change the momentum distribution without knowing the distribution. some way of play with the state from your wave function. I think that by doing this transformation, you're thinking another thing of the and that's obvious in the fact that you have a different line of you're not comparing.
You're absolutely right, and that's a very valid concern. I wrote it this way because it gives me a 1 over n. Maybe a more satisfactory way to do this would be not to rescale at all, but to, when you proceed with the derivation, as I'll show you, you look at the Wigner transform of the wave function, and to make sure that nothing funny is going on, to make sure you know exactly what happens in the scaling limit, what you can do is you look at the Wigner transform of C, you look at the Wigner transform of the unscaled guy, and then you say that you want to look at observables which in position live on the larger scale. Observables, you might say, well, what you do is you take the Wigner transform of the unscaled C, here's something you can do, and then inside of that you multiply position and momentum by n to the 1/3. And if you use this Wigner function to compute averages of observables, the kinds of observables that you're looking at can be described, I guess, geometrically as follows. So suppose that everything lives in a box, and the side of the box has length cube root of n. The kind of position observables I'd think about would just be given by some integration against some function on the unscaled box. So you might say you might want to know one observable would be whether the particles are in the right half of the box. Now, of course, the size of the box is growing, but for any n, you can ask the question, what's the probability that the particle would be found in the right half of the box? Same thing with momentum. You can ask, what's the probability that the unscaled momentum would be found between the cube root of n times p naught and the cube root of n times p1. So these are the kinds of observables that you would end up being able to say something about in the scaling limit. Now it turns out that if you rescale this way and you take the Wigner transform and you look at the limit, which I'll get around to describing in a minute, then it amounts to the same thing. So it's an important concern, but it works out if you think about it carefully. So in this case, what you do is you take the Wigner transform, the rescaled C, which is a function of n positions and n momenta. And then you reduce it by integrating out all of the positions and momenta except for the first one. And subject to certain hypotheses, which are restrictions on the initial conditions of the n particle system, the contracted, let me just call this WC1, the contracted Wigner transform, which is just a function of X1 and P1, will converge in a weak sense to, at time t, will converge to mu of t, the weak solution to this Vlasov equation. But again, I have to play the same game. Once the Coulomb potential tells me how to rescale, once I've done that, in order to get this to be true, well, you might have to mollify the Coulomb potential. However, or at least that used to be the way it was. Ah, excellent question. So it depends whether you take Giovanni's approach or this approach. If you take this approach, then you take the Wigner transform at the scale h, at the scale h bar over 2n, and then you don't rescale the observables. If you take Giovanni's approach, you don't rescale the Wigner transform, but you rescale the observables. Or well, either way, the Wigner transform has to be rescaled. Either you take the Wigner transform with an effective Planck's constant, which depends on n, or you end up doing something like this.
Eventually, the last of the question is it Q and P or X?
X and Q are synonymous.
Well,
you're right. This should be a capital Q and a capital P. And little x is like capital Q. How much time do I have left? Okay, so where I wanted to go from this is that in the first situation, we start with classical dynamics and you end up with a classical equation, namely Vlasov's equation. In the second situation, you start with quantum dynamics and you end up with a classical equation because this effective Planck constant tends to zero. But there are physical situations where you want to be able to derive a quantum effective equation, something like the time-dependent Hartree equation that Giovanni spoke about the other day. And how could that happen? I mean, you want to proceed from the same kind of many-particle equation. Why won't you end up taking an effectively classical limit? Well, this won't happen or shouldn't happen in case you have some sort of confinement on the nanoscale, because then even, for example, if you have suppose I take a solid, which I'll model as jellium. I take two slabs of jellium, which I can think of as being macroscopic, but with a nanoscale, a separation of just a few nanometers between them. And I want to think about tunneling, say. Maybe the gap is just a vacuum, and I want to think about tunneling between them. Or you might just want to think about the field ionization from one piece of metal. So in those cases, nonlinear Schrodinger equations are used, certainly to solve time-independent problems, but also sometimes, and with less justification, to solve time-dependent problems. And the question is, how can you start, if you let n tend to infinity, how can you get a quantum equation in the limit n tends to infinity? And I don't have an answer to that. I did have a little story I wanted to tell about a way you can get an n-particle Schrodinger equation that looks like this, but with an unscaled h-bar, so that you'd still have a 1 over n in front of the potential, which does a lot for you, but an unscaled h-bar. I wanted to tell a story about how you could get that, but I'm afraid I've run out of time.